Thank you for that very generous welcome, and thank you, Mr. President, for that very generous introduction. I didn't deserve it, but I have arthritis, and I don't deserve that either, so I'm grateful for it. When I'm introduced often, people say, well, he needs no introduction, and it's not true. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you three things that happened to me on one day several years ago. I had been the senior news analyst on CBS, the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather. It was just as Walter Cronkite was leaving, and Dan was succeeding him, and I succeeded Eric Severide as the senior news analyst. I was also doing a summer series with one of my dear friends, the late, great North Carolinian Charles Carroll, whom many of you will remember as one of the great writers in American television, great reporters. The end of the series came, and I took a cab from 524 West 57th Street, which is the headquarters of CBS News, to go out to LaGuardia Airport to catch the plane to Shreveport, Louisiana, so I could go over into East Texas to see my parents. I put my suitcase in the trunk of the cab. The suitcase had the black and blue logo of CBS, that famous black and blue eye. It's a little more black and a little more blue now, but it you recognize it. But it didn't have my name on it. So we got to the airport, and the porter pulled the bag out of the trunk. He looked at it. He looked up at me, looked at it again, looked at me, looked at the logo, looked at me, and he said, aren't you on a soap opera? I started to say, yes, the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather, but I didn't think Dan would appreciate that. I went, checked in, was reading the newspaper, and waiting for the plane to board, and a lady came up to me, a senior citizen, and I pulled the paper down. We were staring right in each other's eyes, and she said, oh, I know you. Who are you? True story. Flew to Shreveport, was waiting for that same bag, and another lady came up to me. She said, oh, my goodness. Oh, she said, I can't believe it. Oh, I just love your work, Mr. Carroll. But you look different in person than you look on television. I said, yes, ma'am. On television, I'm fatter and balder. And she said, so help me, she said, that's all right. I love you both ways. The moral of that story, if any of you young people want to go into television, is so much for notoriety. Television makes us intimate strangers. My wife and I were walking down West 77th Street in New York not long ago. Could notice halfway down the block two ladies on the stoop, and one of them had that glint of recognition. I got close to her, and she stood up from the stoop, and she said, do you know who you are? And my wife, who's very quick, said, lady, he's almost 70. He's never figured it out. I'm so glad to be where, for even a couple of hours in the hotel, I can once again listen to North Carolina Public Radio. You have a great system here. I'm also pleased to be back at Guilford. Yes, I was here 45 years ago to ask students, what in the world are you doing? I was one of the organizing directors of the Peace Corps, and my first assignment was to recruit volunteers from college campuses across the country. I came to Guilford on a swing through the Southeast and received my most enthusiastic response here on your campus. I remember that Friendly Avenue was this wide, and only a stray cow was likely to get hit crossing it. I stood on the porch, yes, there was a porch then on Founders Hall, and I let my mind wander through all that had happened here since the Quaker missionary John Woolman had stopped in the wilderness to call upon the first settlers whom he had dubbed planters of truth in the province. I drove a few miles north to where the Battle of Guilford Courthouse was fought during the Revolutionary War. I believe tomorrow is the 225th anniversary of that battle, if I'm not mistaken, and on where the Quakers cared for the wounded of both sides, buried the dead in the Meeting House Cemetery, moving experience standing there looking at the unmarked grave, at the unnamed grave of a British soldier. I strolled around campus then, thinking about the committed souls who had made this place, a station on the Underground Railroad, helping slaves to escape to freedom. This was an isolated spot in a majestic woods, but the people who lived and taught and studied here always seemed to be able to do the best of things in the worst of times. When the world came crashing in on the peace and solitude of this place, the people here seemed to know the right thing to do. During the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, the terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan, there were acts of conscience always at Guilford. A lot of Guilford students signed up for the Peace Corps through the years, and one of your present trustees, Walter Blass, served as our Peace Corps director in Afghanistan in the 1960s. I saw in the fall issue of your college magazine that he had recently traveled to the Ukraine to visit one of your graduates, Elizabeth Ballard, who's a Peace Corps volunteer there now, one of 13 Guilford alumna spread worldwide in the Peace Corps. From your founding days in 1834, 100 years before I was born, Guilford students have been challenged to become critical thinkers while upholding Quaker traditions of community, equality, justice, integrity, and peace. Now that I'm back and I've been exposed to your renewed commitment to Guilford's core values of a transformative liberal arts education that aims to harmonize practice with principle, I wish I were an undergraduate again. That was reinforced this afternoon when I spent some time with some of your students and we had a lively and dynamic exchange. Since I'm not a student, however, I'm honored to be here as a part of the Bryant series, and I'm very grateful, as the President said, to Mr. Bryant, whom I met earlier, for making this series possible and for inviting me and showing up tonight. The Bryant series has a long record of bringing distinguished speakers to Guilford to share their wisdom and virtue, and I apologize that I have to be the one to break that record. Because despite that introduction, I am, after all, just a journalist. We journalists are licensed, so to speak, to explain things we don't understand. And that covers just about everything. I like to say that we are beachcombers on the shores of other people's knowledge, experience, and wisdom. We are not the story, and the story is far more important than we are. That old curmudgeon George Bernard Shaw once observed that journalists are people who are seemingly unable to distinguish between a bicycle accident and the collapse of civilization. If that isn't enough to keep me humble, there was the experience I had when I gave the commencement at Dartmouth a few years ago. A young woman who'd just been graduated came up to me and said, "Mr. Moyers, you've been in government and journalism. That makes everything you say twice as hard to believe." As I said, so much for notoriety. I want to talk to you this evening. We're getting a little late start. It's 8:28. I'm not going to let you out by 9 o'clock. I want to talk with you this evening about a question I was asked by a student at another campus several months ago. He asked me, "What are the two most difficult subjects that I have to cover these days as a journalist?" I gave him a short, off-the-cuff answer at the time, but I've been thinking about that question a lot since he asked it, going back over the work I've done through the years, and I'm going to give you the response I didn't have time to develop with him. By far, the most difficult subject to cover these days is religion. One reason religion is hard to cover is simply the bewildering array of beliefs. I carry with me in my briefcase a Gallup poll about what Americans believe. 54% believe in psychics. 50% believe in extrasensory perception. 41% believe in demonic possession. 38% believe in ghosts. 36% believe in telepathy. 33% believe in extraterrestrial visitation. 32% believe in clairvoyance. And 28% believe in communicating with the dead. You tell me how you cover those beliefs objectively. That's just, of course, part of the story. Once upon a time, this country's religious discourse was dominated by white male Protestants of a culturally conservative European heritage, people like me. Dissenting visions of America, alternative visions of faith or race or women, rarely reached the mainstream. One of my favorite cartoons is when the cartoonist Jeff McNally sums it up with two weirdos who are in a California diner. One weirdo says to the other, "Have you ever delved into the mysteries of Eastern religion?" And the second weirdo answers, "Yes, I was once a Methodist in Philadelphia." Once upon a time, that was about the extent of our exposure to the varieties of religious experience. But it's different now. Our nation is being recreated right before our eyes. Travel the country as I do, and you see an America dotted with mosques in places like Toledo, Phoenix, and Atlanta. You come upon huge Hindu temples in Pittsburgh, Albany, and California's Silicon Valley. There are Sikh communities in Stockton and Queens, New York, and Buddhist retreat centers in the mountains of Vermont and West Virginia. When I was growing up in East Texas, my nurture and my culture told me that I belonged to the one true religion. Then I graduated into the larger world, and life informed me that every religion conveys possible ways of expressing human experience and self-understanding. Because each religion can appear utterly incomprehensible to the other, we're facing what Gerald Bruns describes as a contest of narratives with more meanings than we know what to do. I wish I were going to be around to cover the consequences of this transformation. We simply don't know right now how the world's religions will coexist as they continue to take root in America. Just look at the tensions in Europe between Muslims and the majority. And although we Americans pride ourselves on not only tolerating but also celebrating diversity, tolerance has often been more the ideal than the practice. So we have to ask, how can we avoid the intolerance, the chauvinism, the fanaticism, the bitter fruits that occur when different religions are next-door neighbors? Asking people that question, as I've done the last few years, brings a variety of experiences that compound the difficulty of covering our beliefs. The scholar Elaine Pagels, for example, told me in an interview that there's practically no religion I know of that sees other people in a way that affirms the other's choice. This is the case even within faiths that share common roots. The president made reference to my comments about Baptists. You may have heard of the fellow who was about to jump off a bridge, desperate and distraught, when another guy runs up to him crying, "Stop, stop, don't do it." The man on the bridge looks down and asks, "Why not?" "Well," he says, "there's much to live for." "Like what?" "Well, your faith. Are you religious?" "Yes." "Me too. Christian or Buddhist?" "Christian." "Me too. Are you Catholic or Protestant?" "Protestant." "Me too. Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterian?" "Baptist." "Me too. Are you Baptist Church of God or Baptist Church of the Savior?" "Baptist Church of God." "Me too. Are you Original Baptist Church of God or Reformed Baptist Church of God?" "Reformed Baptist Church of God," said the man on the bridge. "Me too. Are you Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation of 1789? Or Reformed Baptist Church of God, Reformation of 1915? 1915. Whereupon the second fella turned red in the face, shouted, "Die, you heretic scum," and pushed him off the bridge. I mean, how do you cover a subject where differences run so thin? And how in the real world of democracy do we cope with 1,000 local gods? How do I hold my truth to be the truth when everyone else sees truth differently? I put this question some years ago to the renowned scholar of comparative religion, who is to the study of religion what Joseph Campbell was to the study of the world's literature, Houston Smith, who has spent the whole of his adult life trying to penetrate the essence of the world's great religions. I produced a series of those interviews called The Wisdom of Faith with Houston Smith, and if you haven't seen them, I urge you to go to pbs.org and find them. Houston Smith is here tonight, and I would like to ask him to stand. Here he is, right here. Houston, stand up. Houston wrote the classic book for college students on the comparative world religions. It was then called the Religion of Man. It's been changed now to the world's religions. He will be on the campus at Guilford the next couple of days, and I urge all of you students and faculty and townspeople, if you can get in, to go and listen to this man who's lived 87 years, most of those years deeply immersed in the six great religions of the world. He wrote once, "Religions are like rivers, dynamic and changing, bearing the heritage of the past to water the fields of the present. These rivers are converging," he said, "and we need to build bridges." I asked him, how are we to do this? And if you saw that series, The Wisdom of Faith, you saw Houston actually think before he answered. One of those eloquent moments so rare on television when you can actually see someone else thinking. And then he said, Either you're a little slow tonight or am I a little fast. I'm not sure. Then Houston said, "We listen. We listen as alertly to the other people's description of reality as we hope they listen to us." That's what I tried to do a few years ago in another series that my wife and I produced for PBS on the stories of Genesis. Those of you who saw it will remember, and it represents also the complexity of trying to cover religion. Those of you who saw it will remember it was a simple series by television standards, seven people sitting in a circle talking with each other about the 10 stories in Genesis, the first book of the Bible. Three great faiths trace their origins to these stories. They're the quintessential Jewish story. We Christians have adopted them to our canon. And Muslims trace their beginnings back to Abraham and Hagar, and they're born out of wedlock's son, Ishmael. For these three faiths, Genesis is a documentary of the founding generation. And yet, these primal stories speak across those generations with a relevance that is staggering to me. The characters are starkly human. They rage at one another and at God. They're schemers and dreamers and parents who play favorites, and children who curse their parents and run away from home. Here are tales of willful sons and estranged brothers and troubled marriages, lots of envy, lust, fertility, and deception, all of the elements we would describe today as a typically dysfunctional American family. They are people like us, you see, which is why they confront us so directly today and why they make the coverage of religion so complex. But I actually didn't want this series to be a religious exercise. I wanted to do it to explore how do you talk about religion in a democracy, a pluralistic society, without politicizing God or polarizing the community as the religious right has done. I wanted to see if people of varied backgrounds, faiths, professions, ages, and gender could disagree passionately about things that matter without surrendering their own principal beliefs or going for their neighbor's throat. Whether Americans can engage with others in serious conversations about the most deeply felt subjects, our religious beliefs, the nature of faith, our relationship with one another, and truly challenge each other, learn from each other, and teach each other. I've long believed, and one of the reasons I do the television I do, I've long believed that conversation is, as Thomas More has written, the interpretation of worlds. The interpretation of worlds. So I wanted to be sure that our participants in the series didn't come from the same neighborhood. Talking with people who agree with you is like jogging in a cul-de-sac. When I was growing up in East Texas, Baptists talked about the Bible with Baptists, Presbyterians with Presbyterians, Episcopalians with Episcopalians, Methodists with Methodists, and Jews with Jews. But we never talked about the Bible across our faiths, much less across our races. I grew up in a segregated town, Marshall, Texas. But this worked with Genesis. All over the country, people organized into groups to watch the series, different people from different groups, and then talk about each broadcast afterward. One seniors organization alone signed up 1 million of its members to join the conversation. We couldn't have had better material than Genesis. Take the story of Noah. When I was a kid in Sunday school at the Central Baptist Church in Marshall, Texas, we didn't have baseball cards. We had Bible cards depicting scenes from the scriptures. Bill Price was our Sunday school teacher during my adolescence, and he gave us our first Bible cards. Bill Price was a contractor who knew everything about building buildings and almost nothing about the Bible. But he was a good Sunday school teacher and a great guy. He told us Noah's wife was named Joan of Arc. He said the fifth commandment was, humor thy father and mother. Lot's wife was a pillar of fire by day, but at night she was a ball of fire. His name for marriage was Holy Acrimony. And I can still hear him say he was a huge man. Boys, when you grow up, remember that we Christians can only have one wife. That's why it's known as monotony. But the Bible card with Noah, I remember especially. Mr. and Mrs. Noah sitting on the prow of the ark, gazing out toward the horizon at the beautiful rainbow arching across the sky. All the animals gathered around with little smiley faces. The perfect children's story, a real American story with a setting and ending suitable for Disney. But this is no children's story. It raises hard questions about adult behavior. If Noah knew what was coming, why didn't he alert his neighbors or at least his in-laws? He obviously didn't have a brownie. Brownie Katrina. Sorry. I think you've been listening to too much music on North Carolina Public Radio. The fundamentalist will tell you that it was because Noah was just being obedient to God. He was just doing what he was told. His script had been written and he was carried it out. But we have to ask, does obedience carry with it the negation of mercy? Was there no pity in his heart for those in the path of the flood? Was he so intent upon establishing the first chapter for the Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals that he didn't have any concern for his fellow human beings? If you watch the series, you will remember that Karen Armstrong, the author, who's been on my show several times, reminded our group that the original title on which Schindler's List is based was Schindler's Ark. The author, Timothy Kinley, thought the image of the Ark was appropriate for Oskar Schindler's factory, where he saved hundreds of intended victims of the Nazi Holocaust. Now, Schindler was no righteous man in the conventional sense of the world. He was a playboy, a philanderer, the kind of fellow God would probably have drowned in Noah's day, if you believe the fundamentalist. And yet, Oskar Schindler risked his life to rescue the doomed and the damned. Most of his contemporaries behave like Noah. They blocked out all knowledge of the carnage as we do in Iraq, obeying their superiors in order to save themselves, trying to ride out the storm in safety. I was confronted during that discussion by a very hard question. If I had been raised in Munich, Germany, instead of Marshall, Texas, born in 1934, would I, as a Christian, have tried to save anyone? These stories present us with tough questions. How do we interpret Noah's conduct after the flood? He was clearly traumatized when he got off the boat, and the first thing he did was to build an altar. Now, all the preachers I heard as a kid said this confirmed his righteousness, proving he deserved to be saved. But just a few verses later, Noah gets drunk, curses his children, and abuses his grandson. In other words, no sooner does God save this man, giving humanity a second chance, than the rainbow fades into alcoholism, drug abuse, and child abuse. Tough questions. In many ways, I've come to think of Noah as the quintessential 20th century and 21st century figure. In the Jewish mystical teachings, the Kabbalah, the world never really escaped the devastation of the flood. It represents metaphorically the dilemmas of our society and our times. Its waters rage all around us and within us as well. How do you cover that? What about God in this story? I tell you, keeping up with God as a journalist is a very prodigious task. I was taught that when God saved Noah, he was showing compassion. But as I grew older, I realized that this is not the story of a good God saving a good man from a natural disaster. This is the story of a good God saving a good man from a bad God. And the horror of the story is that the good God and the bad God are one and the same God. In the first chapter of Genesis, not once but seven times, God says of creation, it's good. But just six chapters and 10 generations later, God is so appalled by the violence and the corruption of humanity that God drowns everyone except Noah and his family and the animals they could get on the ark. Surely there were children on the earth too young for corruption. What does it say that we've come to revere a story whose God had no place for them? Do I want anything to do with a God who does that? The God of Genesis is a God of radical unpredictability, combining immense physical power with terrifying moral ambivalence. And we get in the silences of this text the question that haunts our genocidal times. Why must the innocent suffer? And what does this mean for faith? These two questions I get more often when I talk on television and privately with people about religion. I have to tell you that sometimes in my own conversation with God on the interstellar cell phone, the battery goes dead. One of our participants in the series told of the Jews condemned to die in the concentration camp of Auschwitz. Day after day, they are marched into the gas chamber. But one day, the survivors decided they'd had enough. They decide God must be tried for having let all this horror happen. They convene a tribunal. They hear all the evidence. They pass their judgment. They pronounce God guilty, and they sentence God to die. No sooner than the judgment is rendered than one old rabbi gets up and says, "All right, the trial is over. It's time for the evening prayer." At the heart of deep faith is an old contradiction. I believe, help thou my unbelief. There's a growing field of neuropsychology and neuroscience that holds that we are wired for belief. I'm going out to San Diego to speak with a couple of those people next month to talk about whether there's a documentary in this. How can you track the fact that people may be wired for belief? One of our most fascinating discussions centered on the story of Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel are the first parents to discover what it means to, Adam and Eve are the first parents to discover what it means to raise Cain. They have a, thank you. They have a second son named Abel. Both boys want to please God, so both boys bring God offerings. Cain is a farmer, and he offers the first fruit of the soil. Abel is a shepherd and offers the first lamb from the flock. Two very generous gifts, but God plays favorites, and he chooses Abel's offering over Cain's. And the elevation of the younger leads to the humiliation of the elder, and Cain is so jealous that he strikes out at his younger brother and kills him. Here's the first paradox we confronted in our discussion, and it's the greatest paradox a journalist in war zones these days faces. Abel is innocent, and yet Abel dies. If you saw the broadcast, you know that at this particular point, the novelist Mary Gordon, a struggling Catholic, says, "This is the hopeless moment, the realization that goodness and purity do not protect you. It did not protect the Jews. It did not protect the Africans sold into slavery. It did not protect the Native Americans. Goodness and purity of heart, she said, are irrelevant to your fate and punishment. In the end, Abel is dead, and dead is dead, and God did nothing about it. This, says Mary Gordon, is the narrative moment when doubt becomes almost comprehensible, absolutely comprehensible, and almost inevitable. But she goes on to express poignantly what it means to be a survivor. Mary Gordon says the challenge for a moral person is to be a witness to Abel. To be an ethical human being, she believes, is to say, I'm in the place of that person unjustly cut down. I am a witness to that. All of us are survivors of the 20th century, one of the most horrendous centuries in human history. Are we good witnesses to the losers? Here's the second paradox. The first, murder, rose out of a religious act. Both Cain and Abel are rivals for God's favor. Their rivalry leads to violence and ends in death. And once this pattern is established, it's played out in the story of Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau, Joseph and his brothers, and down through the centuries and generation after generation of conflict between Muslims and Jews, Jews and Christians, Christians and Muslims, so that the red thread of religiously spilled blood runs directly from east of Eden to Bosnia, to Belfast, to Baghdad, to every place in the world where the compassion of brothers and sisters, believers and seekers, turns to competition and rivalry. As James Wiggins says in the praise of religious diversity, virtually every armed conflict that is occurring on the planet today is driven by explicitly religious motives or by memory traces of persisting religious conflict. So we saw fundamentalists in Algeria who want to make their country an Islamic theocracy shooting teenage girls in the face for not wearing a veil and cutting professors' throats for teaching male and female students in the same classroom. We saw Muslim suicide bombers killing busloads of Jews and a fanatical Jewish doctor with a machine gun mowing down 30 praying Muslims in a mosque. We saw the young Orthodox Jew who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin declaring on television, everything I did for the glory of God. In India, Hindus and Muslims slaughter one another. Here in America, Muslims bomb the World Trade Center in order to smite the great Satan. Timothy McVeigh blows up the federal building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people, in part as revenge against the government for killing David Koresh and his cult. Groups calling themselves the Christian Identity Movement and the Christian Patriot League collect arsenals, and at a political convention not too long ago, at a so-called Christian booth in the exhibit hall, I could buy an apron with two pockets, one for the Bible and one for a gun. Religion has a healing side, we know this, but religion also has a killing side. Often in our sessions, we disagreed. And sometimes the more we talked, the more we disagreed. We were critical. We were skeptical. No one was politely dishonest enough to let a point pass that called for a challenge. Talking about the issues exposed, as I said, our differences. Talking about them made us think about them. But it also connected people who had been strangers in the past when they first met. Sometimes we discovered that despite our differences, we shared some fundamental values with people who seemed most unlike us. We were constantly reminded that differences between faiths are real and shouldn't be papered over for protocol's sake, but we discovered that minds, hearts, and lives can be profoundly touched with genuine understanding when you listen to the loves of others. The call, you see, is not to pride. The call is to humility. Kathleen Norris, in one of her poems, says, "We're all God's children now." And in the next breath, she says, "God help us, because we are." But in the words of the Jewish theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel, no religion is an island. We're all involved with one another, and spiritual betrayal on the part of one affects the faith of all. Which brings me to the second most difficult subject to cover today, in no small part because of religion, and that is the environment. I've been on this beat ever since my first documentary on the subject some 30 years ago. That was a story about how the new Republican governor of Oregon, Tom McCall, had set out to prove that the economy and the environment could share the center lane on the highway to the future. I thought then that when people saw a good example, they would imitate it, that if Americans knew the facts and the possibilities, they would act on them. After all, I'd grown up at the University of Texas, walked across the campus every day, looked up at that great tower and saw the words chiseled there, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." I believed that. I believed 30 years ago that we really were on the road toward the third American Revolution. The first had won our independence as a nation. The second had finally opened the promise of civil rights to all Americans. Now, the third American Revolution was to be the Green Revolution for a healthy, safe, and sustainable future. Sometimes, in a moment of reverie, I imagine that it happened. I imagine that we had brought forth a new paradigm for nurturing and protecting our global life support system, that we'd faced up to the greatest ecological challenge ever and conquered it with clean, renewable energy, efficient transportation and agriculture, and the non-toxic production and protection of our forests, oceans, grasslands, and wetlands. I imagined us leading the world on a new path of sustainability. It was only a reverie. The reality is quite different. Rather than leading the world in finding solutions to the global environmental crisis, the United States has become a recalcitrant naysayer and backslider. Let me give you just one example. Just this weekend comes yet another report that researchers have uncovered compelling evidence that indicates life's most vulnerable regions, the North and South Poles, are poised on the brink of a climactic disaster. According to the independent newspaper in London, The Observer, scientists at an atmospheric monitoring station in Norway have found that levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere near the North Pole are rising at an unprecedented pace. This, of course, is a key cause of global warming, as the polar regions absorb more heat from the sun, causing the ice to melt still further. The relentless cycle of melting and heating will shrink the massive land glaciers and dramatically raise sea levels. In 1990, the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere near the North Pole was rising at a rate of 1 part per million. Recently, that rate reached 2 parts per million. Now it's rising at between 2.5 and 3 parts per million. And in the last 2 decades, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have risen from 350 to 400 parts per million. And scientists warn that once the levels reach 500, there could be irreversible consequences that would tip the planet toward disaster. Glacier melts, as you know, triggering devastating rises in sea levels and spreading deserts across Africa and Asia. The scientists that I've talked to are desperate for politicians to reach agreements that will prevent the tipping point from being reached in the next half century. This new data suggests that we have a far shorter period in which to act. Nonetheless, last year a Gallup poll found that nearly half of Americans worry, quote, only a little or not at all about global warming or the greenhouse effect. In July of last year, ABC News reported that 66% of the people in a new survey don't think that global warming will affect their lives in any way. If you've seen the film March of the Penguins, have you seen it? You know it's a delight to the eye and a tug at the heart. The camera follows the flocks as they trek back and forth over the ice to their breeding ground. You see them huddle together to protect their eggs in temperatures that average 70 degrees below Fahrenheit. So beautiful and powerful a film can only increase one's awe of our small neighbors, the creatures at the pole. In the New York Times, not long ago, though, Jonathan Miller reported that conservatives are invoking March of the Penguins as an inspiration for their various causes. Some praise the penguins for their monogamy. Opponents of abortion say it verifies, quote, the beauty of life and the rightness of protecting it. A Christian magazine claims it makes, quote, a strong case for intelligent design. And if you go to the website lionsofgod.com, you can find instructions to take a notebook, flashlight, and pen to the movie to write down what God speaks to you as you watch the film. Fair enough. It would not be the first time human beings felt connected to a transcendent power through nature. But what you will not see in that film is any reference to global warming. Why is it relevant? Because to reproduce, the penguins must go to the thickest part of the ice where they can safely stand without fear that it will fall beneath their weight. Global warming obviously weakens the ice. If it becomes too thin, the penguins will lose the support necessary for reproduction. Yet this film is silent on this threat to these creatures that conservatives have adopted as their mascot in the culture wars. The film's director explained that he wanted to reach as many people as possible, and since, quote, much of public opinion appears insensitive to the dangers of global warming, he didn't want to go there. Again, fair enough. I can't fault him for the aspiration to tell the story for its own sake in the most simple and profound way. I can't fault him for wanting to avoid disturbing the comfort of viewers. I often wish that I were a filmmaker instead of a journalist and didn't have to give people a headache by reporting the news they'd rather not hear. But what we don't know can kill us. Our oldest son is addicted to alcohol and drugs. I'm not spilling any family secrets here. My wife Judith and I produced a PBS series some years ago on his and our family's experience, and we called it Close to Home because we wanted to remind people that addiction hijacks the brain, irrespective of race, creed, color, or street address. He's doing well, thank you. He's been in recovery for 10 years and has become one of the country's leading public advocates for treatment. He's been here a couple of times in Greensboro speaking on the subject. But we almost lost him more than once because he was in denial, and so were we. For a decade prior to his crash, he would not admit to himself what was happening, and he was able to hide it from us. He was, after all, a rising star in journalism at CNN, married, a homeowner, and a God-fearing churchgoer. Naturally, his mother and I believed the best about him. A drug addict slowly poisoning himself to death, not our son. The day before he crashed, I'd grown so concerned about his behavior that I asked him to lunch with me. "Are you in trouble?" I asked. Are you using?" He looked me squarely in the eyes and said, "No, Dad, not at all. I'm just having a few problems at home." "Phew," I said, and placed my hand on his. "I'm really glad to hear that," I said, and I switched the subject. The next day, he was gone. We searched for days before his mother and a friend tracked him down and coaxed him from a crack house to the hospital. What we don't know can kill us. They say that denial is not a river in Egypt. Well, it is the governing philosophy in many of the pulpits of this country, and in the bulliest pulpit of all, the White House. The president's contempt for science, for evidence that mounts every day, boggles my mind. Here is a man who was quick to launch a preventive war against Iraq on faulty intelligence and premature judgment, but who refuses to take action against a truly global menace about which the scientific evidence is overwhelming. I think there can only be three reasons for it. One, he lives in a self-imposed bubble, and as he said, he gets his information only from his staff members, not from reading anything else, because that's the best source for him. The other is that he is utterly beholden to his corporate patrons and campaign contributions. Theodore Roosevelt, a Republican, warned a century ago of the subversive power of money in politics. He said the central fact in his time was that big business had become so dominant it could chew up democracy and spit it out. The power of corporations, he said, had to be balanced with the general public interest. That warning was echoed by his cousin Franklin, who said that a government by organized money is as much to be feared as the government by organized mob. Both Roosevelts, one a progressive Republican, the other a liberal Democrat, rose to the challenge. But 100 years later, multinational corporations are once again the overlords of our government. They own our environmental policy lock, stock, and barrel. And their grip on our country's environmental policies is leading to calamitous consequences. Once the leader in cutting-edge environmental policies and technologies and awareness, America is now eclipsed. Even as the scientific evidence grows, pointing to a crisis, we have become the impediment to action, not the leader. The White House last year even conducted an extraordinary secret campaign to scupper the British government's efforts to tackle global warming. The administration has, even as we speak, been trying to undermine the United Nations effort to stabilize the greenhouse gas emissions human beings are pouring into the atmosphere. The president's failure to lead on global warming means that even if we were dramatically overnight to decrease greenhouse gases, we have already condemned ourselves and generations to come to a warmer planet and all that follows. The third reason the president is blind or indifferent to this issue is his Christian constituency. Without the Christian right, the corporations that now control Washington would not have the votes to eviscerate our environmental protections. Consider this. 45% of Americans hold a creational view of the world. Millions of them accept the literal story of Genesis that I talked about. And they either dismiss or distrust a lot of science, not only evolution, but paleontology, archaeology, geology, genetics, even biology and botany. Compare that to other industrial nations where climate change is overwhelmingly accepted as real. In Britain, for example, where 81% of the populace wants the government to implement treaties to reverse greenhouse emissions. What's going on here? Simply that to those people who believe our history began with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and believe it literally, not metaphorically, as I was speaking, and who believe that it will soon end on the plains of Armageddon, as they do. I was filming at a biblical prophecy conference last week for a documentary we're doing in the fall on this subject. Believing that it will soon end, the history of the human race, on the plains of Armageddon, environmental science, with its urgent warnings of planetary peril, may look at the best to them, well, irrelevant. If you believe the Lord will provide for all human needs and never leave us short of oil or other resources, no matter how we overpopulate the earth, scientists and journalists who report the story are viewed as directly attacking the biblical teachings that urge humans to be fruitful and multiply. This makes the environment a tough beat, made more so by people who may conscientiously believe God will not allow us to do ourselves in. There are moments I come back from filming utterly distraught at our chances. But I can't give up. You can't give up. Too much is at stake. I see what's at stake every time I go to my desk. There beside my computer are photographs of Henry 13, Thomas 11, Nancy 9, Jassy 5, and Sarah Jane 2. I look at those pictures and I see the future looking back at me. Yet my grandchildren have no voice in politics. They have no vote. They don't have a Jack Abramoff to represent them in the nation's capital. They only have me, their old grandfather, and hopefully you. Let me see if I can drive this home. During my final year on that weekly PBS series, Now with Bill Moyers, we produced a documentary called Endangered Species about a neighborhood in Washington, D.C., known as Anacostia, just a few blocks from Capitol Hill. It's one of the most violent and dangerous neighborhoods in the city, one of those places that give Washington the horrendous distinction of the highest murder rate of any major city in America. It's horrendous in other ways, too. The Anacostia River that gives the neighborhood its name is one of the most polluted in America. More than 1 billion gallons of sewage, raw sewage, end up in it every year. We went there to report on the Earth Conservation Corps, a project to recruit neighborhood kids to help clean up the river and community. For their efforts, they earn minimum wage, get health insurance, and are offered a $5,000 scholarship if they go back to school. The area where they work is practically a war zone. Since the project began, an average of one Corps member has been murdered almost every year. One was beaten to death, one was raped and killed, another died when he was caught in the middle of a shooting while riding his bike. Three were shot execution style. One of the most charismatic of the kids who joined the Corps was named Diamond Teague. He worked so hard at the project that others jokingly called him the choir boy. His work became his passion. He loved it. It gave purpose and meaning to his life to try to clean up the neighborhood and the river. But one morning while he was sitting on his porch, someone walked up and shot him in the head. It's that kind of place, not far from where the swells of Congress are hosted and toasted by lobbyists for America's most powerful and privileged interests, and where the preachers and pastors and evangelists and telepreachers come and pray over the Congress and pray at the White House and have their annual prayer breakfast, careful never to go to Anacostia. After his death, Diamond Teague got the only press of his short life, 43 words in the Washington Post. Quote, a teenager was found fatally shot about 2:05 Thursday in the 2200 block of Prout Street Southwest, police said. Diamond D. Teague, 19, who lived on the block, was pronounced dead. That's all. That was Diamond's obit. Not a word about his work for the Conservation Corps. Not a word. It was left to his friends to tell the world about Diamond T. One of them explained to us that they wanted the world to know that just because a black man gets killed in the southeast corner of the nation's capital doesn't mean he's a drug dealer or gangbanger. We shouldn't just discount him as nobody when he deserves for people to know about his life. They made a video. If you saw our report, you saw part of it. They turned out for his funeral in uniform. They wept and they prayed for their fallen friend. And then they went back to work on a dusty patch of land squeezed between two factories that they envision will one day be a park. We see the bigger picture, one of Diamond Teague's friends said to me. All great things have to start in roughness. We're just at the beginning of something that's going to be beautiful, she said. They said they would call it the Diamond Teague Memorial Park in honor of their friend who was trying to save an endangered river and an endangered neighborhood, but couldn't save himself. On that fleck of land where anything beautiful must be born in roughness, they see the bigger picture. While just blocks away, at the opposite end of Pennsylvania Avenue, in the White House and the Capitol, the blind lead the blind on one more march of folly. Joseph Campbell used a powerful metaphor to drive home what I'm talking about. Campbell's imagination had been fired when his father took him as a boy to the Museum of Natural History in New York City, and he was exposed to the masks and totems in the hall of Native people. Campbell went on to become one of the century's foremost scholars of mythology, and my series with Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth, is probably the most popular I've done in my long career in public broadcasting. If you saw that, you remember that Campbell told me the story of Black Elk, a Sioux Indian about the age of 9, who had a prophetic vision of what he called the hoop of the nation. He saw that the hoop of his tribe, his nation, was one of many hoops. All the hoops, all the nations linked in a grand procession. In that vision, says Black Elk, I saw myself on the central mountain of the world, the highest place, and I was seeing the sacred mountain of the world. And the sacred mountain of the world, he said, was Harney Peak in South Dakota. And then he says, Black Elk says, but the central mountain is everywhere. Joseph Campbell said this is a true mythological realization. We live locally, Greensboro, on Harney's Peak. And by itself, this translates into a kind of raw individualism, ourself alone on the mountain. But there is another connotation. You're the central mountain. You're the central mountain. You're the central mountain. You and you. In fact, turn to your left and look. Turn to your left and look. You're looking at the central mountain. Now turn to your right and look. You're looking at the central mountain. Everything is connected. This deep spiritual understanding is the basic truth of life, the source of peace and justice and freedom. And it's time that our politics caught up with it. Whether it does, depends on each of you sitting there on the central mountain. You're a great audience. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
To that, all I can say, everybody say amen. Amen. We have time for a few questions and answers, and at the end of this, we will have some information about next year's Bryan series. And I want to remind you, too, that Bill Moyers will be in the auditorium lobby signing books in just a few moments. But, Bill, I wanted to start with some questions that were passed out from the audience earlier, and I thought I'd start with this one. As the sensible, level-headed person that you are, Flattery will get you everywhere. Please help those of us who are feeling rather cynical, jaded, yet still hopeful, with words of wisdom as to how we idealists can still hope for our democratic country that seems to be losing its civil liberties.
Well, I'm asked that question all the time, and I'm unable to give you a strategy. I'm unable to give you a grand plan. You know Greensboro. You know where you live. You've got to find something in there that you can do tomorrow that makes you feel like a moral and political agent. After 9/11, PBS called me and said, would you go on the air tomorrow night and just talk every night for half an hour with anybody you want to talk to? So one of my first guests was the great psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, did the marvelous study of the victims of Hiroshima, veterans of the Vietnam War, a great, great psychiatrist. And I said to him, what do you think we can do to deal with our grief, with what's happening? He said, get out tomorrow morning and do something political. Doesn't have to be partisan, it can be, but do something political that joins you in an action that may have a chain reaction. In an action that may have a chain reaction. You can't imagine the exhilaration of discovering that even one small victory, such as getting a stop sign on your corner, can make you feel connected to others who are working in similar ways. Now, that's a very tiny thing, but it's something I believe. I do something political. Join with others. Don't be content just to stay on the internet. If you do, take the advice of what's on the internet and find somebody else who's on the internet who wants to do something in the real world out there about what you're doing. You've got to get involved in precinct politics again and take the country back from the great powers and principalities There was a story in the Washington Post yesterday from the chairman of the Federal Election Committee saying that if you're going to be a candidate for president in the year 2008, you will have to have raised $100 million by the end of next year just to be a player. $100 million. It's incredible. Well, you know what's going to solve that in time is the public funding of our elections. I came down here, but it needs your help. I came down here 6 years ago, and I spoke to a gathering of your political and corporate elites, and I talked about public funding because I run a small foundation that's concerned with that. Senator Bob Morgan, former Senator Bob Morgan, some of your justices set that up. As a result of that campaign, I had very little to do with it, but as a result of that campaign, you now have in North Carolina funding for judicial candidates, trying to remove that choice from being controlled by big corporate money and special interests. What I'm saying is, get it. There's a movement going on in the country. 30 states have organizations working to produce clean money, that is, the public funding of campaigns. There's one here in North Carolina. Get involved. Fight for that. We won't win in our time, but just as with slavery, abolition, women's suffrage, the fight to end child labor, the fight of labor of workers to organize, those came about long after the originators had passed on. But be part of something where you think there is an outcome that may make a difference. I can't answer that for you. I can't. You have to answer that. It is the right question, and only you can provide the right answer. But do something political.
Another question is, you spoke earlier of the influence of those who hold a literal view of creation on ecological and environmental policy. Would you comment also on the need for eco-justice in America and its roots in Christianity and Judaism, especially when you think of stewardship of the land?
Well, there is a very powerful tradition in the Christian faith of progressive and prophetic politics, from the Jewish prophets of the Hebrew Bible to the teachings of Jesus. Prophetic, progressive religion has been a powerful force. William Jennings Bryan got a raw deal, frankly, with that Scopes trial because he ran for president three times, was one of the most popular men in America. But he was a deeply committed Christian, a liberal Christian for those days. And it was because of what liberal William Jennings Bryan did that later Teddy Roosevelt and Harry Truman and JFK and Lyndon Johnson had a basis for invoking many of the measures that we enacted. The movement for slavery. I mean, look, just face it. The Christian and Jewish prophetic voice in this country has been very, very powerful. But it's been drowned out in the last 25 years by this machine that is formed of rich people who contribute huge sums of money to politics and the religious right, which has its social values out there that it cares about more than anything else and doesn't care very much about the religion, about the right. But there, very recently, in the national, from the National Association of Evangelicals, 85 members of the evangelical community signed a statement calling for action on global warming. They were immediately shot at by the Chuck Colsons and the James Dobsons and the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons of this world, but they at least they spoke up and they signed a paper. That's a very encouraging sign. So those of you who are mainstream religious people, it's not enough to just be in the pew, as you know. We have a rich heritage of speaking truth to power, and in the civil rights movement, it was the Jews driven by their prophetic prophets and Christian activists who took part. Look at Tom Fox. I mean, what a great testimony to the power of conscience to make a witness. When you believe something, stand up. Find a place to act on it. You never know what the consequences of that will be. I will just tell. I've talked too long, but I was in the Oval Office when President Johnson asked Martin Luther King to come see him for the first time. He was going to try to talk him out of holding the march in the South because he thought in the leading up to the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it would discombobulate the Southern senators that wanted to do something, but they weren't sure they wanted to be responsive to a demand to do something. So LBJ, being a master parliamentarian and knowing how to move the pieces around on a chess table, pleaded with Martin Luther King, don't hold that demonstration. Give me time. I'll negotiate one-on-one with the 99 members of the Senate. I'll get some bill passed, and if you go out and march in the streets, you know, they won't come along. They'll say they're having to yield to pressure, and they won't do that. Martin Luther King talked him around from that position, and when they finally left, LBJ put his arm around Martin Luther King and said, Dr. King, you go out there and make it possible for me to do the right thing. You make it possible for me to do the right thing. I think we've got to get involved. You know, we need a new Boston Tea Party in order to take this country, to return to return democracy to a nation ruled by money. So get involved in that movement and make it necessary for the politicians who do run to do the right thing.
These are related questions then. One is, can the political left attract religious voters, and if so, how? And what do you think would be the best way to disentangle the religious right and current politics?
Well, you've got to beat them. No, I'm serious. Somebody said to me once, the only way to compromise with the fundamentalist is to obey him. Because if you believe literally and that you know the mind of God, there's no room for a democratic discourse. If you know that God has said this is what you need to do, we can't have compromise. Democracy depends on compromise. They have to be beaten on the environment, in electoral politics, on all these other issues. They have to be beaten. And it can't be just liberal or leftist Christians. It's got to be the big, broad center. I mean, all the polls show that over 50-some-odd percent of the people support these main issues we're talking about, the environment, the right of a woman to defend herself against the power of the state to coerce a termination, to coerce her pregnancy. On all the big issues, the majority of the people are basically centrist positive, progressive. And yet, because of money and religious fanaticism, extremism, they've got a lock on the United States state government. They just have to be taken on and beaten. You can't reason with fundamentalists, and you can't reason with the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons and the James Dobsons, because they have turned their churches into pews of a partisan agenda, and that's the only way.
And one last question, I think that just about everybody in this auditorium would like to know the answer to this, is what are your future plans for more television programs?
Well, I retired, as you know, from the weekly broadcast. I was going to take last year. My wife and I travel a couple of months to places we long delayed, because with a weekly broadcast, I could hardly ever leave New York. But we went to Vienna for a week with Walter and Betsy Cronkite. I'm glad we did that, just because 6 weeks later, she died. We went to Mexico. We went to France. We went to several places just to get away after three intensive years. But then I got angry, you know. I just realized that what was happening, and I started making some speeches. And as I was saying to the president of Guilford today, Internet's become a kind of Hyde Park, and I found that if I took my soapbox out to the Hyde Park, the speeches would resonate around the web, around the cyberspace. So I kept making speeches that I felt I was freer to make now that I was not out of, not on the air. In fact, the main reason I left my weekly broadcast is because I recognized that Karl Rove's appointment to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the chairman of CPB, a man named Kenneth Tomlinson. I was there when CPB was set up under the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. That was supposed to be a heat shield to protect producers and journalists and station managers from political pressure as your money came through to public broadcasting. And they were not doing that. In fact, Ken Tomlinson was there to effect a right-wing coup over public broadcasting. I recognized this. I saw it. I was told this by a number of people. I had the evidence, but I couldn't use my airtime to defend us or to respond to him. So I said I have to fight him by being off the air. And I left, and I started making speeches, and I went to see people in Washington and explained what he was doing. Finally, members of Congress asked the Inspector General to do a study of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, found all kinds of irregularities, breaking the law, using money without approval by the chairman, by the right-wing chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. He was forced to resign. Now that that's over, I feel comfortable in coming back to the air, consistent with a man my age. And we've started production on a seven-part series that will air this summer called Speaking Personally, in which I will talk to a number of leading thinkers about how they feel about the world today. One of them is Terry Tempest Williams, who's a great environmentalist in the West. One of them is Oz Guinness, who's a great theologian. There are several people. Then I'm doing three major in terms of time and subject and expenditure of money that I've raised. I raise every penny of every production I'm out on public broadcasting. I feel independent that way. I don't like to take money from the system unless it's a series they wanted to do. So I'm doing three specials that I'm filming right now, in fact. One is on evangelicals and the environment and the growing schism in their ranks over dealing with global warming in particular. I'm doing one on what big corporations are trying to do with the Internet. I was telling the students at Guilford today, you know, we think of the Internet as all this information, but really the Internet is just a series of pipes. It's just plumbing, the electronic plumbing of our universe. And the intelligence, the information, is on both ends of the plumbing, and anybody can check in and send intelligence and information down through those pipes. It's called network neutrality. The pipes are neutral. They don't take a side. They don't choose between liberal or conservative, left or right, or what. But big corporations are right now trying to move a bill through Congress that would enable them to take over the pipes, put the information and the intelligence in the center of it, and then control your access to that intelligence and the information with big, expensive toll booths. Nobody knows that except a few nerds who follow it. It's a big story. We're trying to turn it into a television documentary. And then the third documentary is a two-hour special on the Abramoff scandal, trying to connect the dots. All you hear, essentially, is that Abramoff has been indicted or pleaded guilty, and then somebody else has been accused of this or that. But when you connect those dots together, you really see that this was a vast collusion between big corporations, members of Congress, and the religious right. Ralph Reed and Tom DeLay were claiming the mantra of God for this. And I'm trying to put those pieces together in a way that enables you to see the story whole and not just in bit by bit or drop by drop. So that's going to keep me busy for the next few months. Thank you for asking. Thank you. Thank you very much.